I call Senate Resources Committee to order. Today is Monday, January 26, 2015. Let the record reflect that the time is 3:33 p.m. Committee members present today, Vice Chair Senator Costello, Senator Stoltz, Senator Stedman, Senator Machicki, Senator Coghill, Senator Walnutkowski, and myself, Senator Giesel. So welcome, everyone. Today, don't let me forget, our recording secretary, we've got Ann Krekelberg on duty. Thatcher is handling the audio system, and my staff is Ike. So today we're going to be focusing on the topic of confidentiality in our state agencies. So the purpose of this hearing is to educate the public, define terms, and show how the confidentiality element works in our current system. So we've got, let's see, 4 speakers today. We're going to start out with Chad Hutchinson. He's going to do an overview. Chad, I'll invite you to the table. After that, Acting Commissioner Randall Hoffbeck will come from the Department of Revenue, talk about their use of confidentiality. Then Acting Director Paul Decker from the Division of Oil and Gas will speak. Lastly, hopefully we'll have time, will be Jenik Mayer and Nico Safus, who are principals in Analytica, who will also discuss the use of confidentiality. And Kathy Forster, pardon me, yes, sorry. And Commissioner Kathy Forster from AOGCC will be between Acting Commissioner Hoffbeck and Paul Decker. Welcome, Chad. As you know, for the record, please identify yourself and your affiliation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Chad Hutchinson. I'm the staff for Senator Coghill, and I work with the majority. Today I'm going to be talking about an overview related to confidentiality agreements and Alaska government. This relates to both the executive branch and the legislative branch. For the purposes of this presentation, I'm going to start out with some of the basics. Who's involved with these confidentiality agreements? What's in the agreements themselves? When do they occur? Where do they occur, and why are they important from the perspective of Alaska state government? I'm also going to give a brief history as to some of the confidentiality agreements that have occurred throughout the history of Alaska. So this is a slide for the public. This is slide 3. What is a confidentiality agreement? For this committee, it's going to be mostly a review. It's an agreement between the parties where information of a proprietary nature is disclosed between the parties and is not to be disclosed to the public or to a third party. Examples of proprietary information include confidential data, research, books, trade secrets, business operations, strategic materials, things of that nature. In some cases, the confidential agreement goes forward between the parties just to see if the transaction itself can go forward. So what else may be included in some of these confidentiality agreements? The parties' investigation of some of the assets, some of the locations where some of the property issues may occur. There's return clauses in some of them. That deals with the fact that if the deal does not go through, that the proprietary information is returned to the parties as soon as practicable. It also may involve discussions as it relates to future transactions, and it also may involve issues related to press releases or public announcements, depending on how large the project is.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Stoltz.
I didn't interrupt the presentation, but the public record is
real important. I've done a lot of research, and the three documents we have from the administration were early, clearly denoted with the authorship and so forth. The one from our legislative branch isn't. You'd have to guess where this came from. And I just think it's, of all people, I've been very critical of the administration trying to save on letterhead by giving us something on typing paper and in the past. I think it's really important for the public record. And I mean, the first person, I'd be picking on the administration for not, but they're 3-3 and we're 0-1.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Sure. I'm sure Mr. Hutchinson will correct that.
Senator Stoltz, through the chair, the presentation was prepared by me, and I apologize for that. So we're on slide 5. Other elements that are included in a confidentiality agreement include damages provisions related to injuries, the recoverable steps, whether injunctive relief may or may not be available. And if there is a dispute, what sort of alternative dispute resolution may occur, and what is the court of a relevant jurisdiction? They also sometimes include assignment clauses between the parties. So why is this all important? The intent is that there needs to be an honest assessment as between the parties as it relates to some of these transactions going forward. And the example given is that in the oil industry there may be disclosures of transportation cost evaluation practices, and that may be valuable for other competitors. So this is the research portion of the presentation, and it deals with some of the history involved with confidentiality agreements in the state of Alaska. We're going to get into some of the statutes as we go through this, and some real-life examples of when confidentiality agreements have been used by the state, whether it be the executive branch or the legislative branch going forward, as it deals with private entities. So whenever you're talking about confidentiality, you have to start with AS 40-25-110A, and this specifically says that unless specifically provided otherwise, public records of all public agencies are open to inspection. The second level of analysis is found more in 40-25-120, and basically that is used after balancing the right to public access with the privacy rights guaranteed in the state constitution and the need for government officials to engage in policy deliberation without undue influence. So as a result, you have 40-25-120, which outlines a number of exceptions to public records requirements, and those include trade secrets, proprietary information, and so forth. So all in all, the 47 statute titles, there is at least 34 statute titles that include some provision that relates to confidential agreements. Here's a list. This is slide 8, 7 statutes allow or require the executive or legislative branches and their employees to enter confidentiality agreements. We're going to hear more on some of the statutes you see listed there. The first one is the Gasline Development Corp. It's a general provision related to confidentiality agreement. We may hear more from the subsequent speakers. The Alaska Retirement Management Board confidentiality agreements come into play whenever they're looking at financial investment decisions going forward. You have the Department of Natural Resources, AS 3805020. That's the AK LNG project. You have the Department of Revenue as relates to AS 40-25-100, and that relates to the tax information of individual taxpayers. The exception there is that you can have aggregate tax information that certainly the members of this committee are experienced with when we go through tax policy with oil and gas issues. 40-25-120A through 13 through 14, another general provision as it relates to AGDC. 4305-095C is Department of Revenue again, and this relates to indirect expenditure reports that are submitted to the Senate Finance Committee the first year July 1st of the first regular session. AS 4398060 relates to DNR and DOR related to the Oil and Gas Competitive Review Board, which takes into account activity and investment information, and its confidentiality agreements are related to that because of proprietary information that may come forward as they analyze those issues. And then there's two additional statutes related to information and the North Slope Gas Line construction, AS 4382-10 and AS 4390-160. Both of those apply to applications, whether it be for development of a contract or for a GEO license itself.
Mr. Hutchinson, a question.
Sure.
You didn't call out AOGCC, which we'll hear from at some point, so you didn't call out all of them.
Yep. Madam Chair, that's correct. And this is a non-exhaustive list. This is just examples of where confidentiality agreements do occur throughout the state. So it's not intended to be exhaustive, yeah.
I think the Alaska Railroad also has a lot of proprietary information, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep.
Pause for a moment. Any further questions from other committee members? Okay, go ahead.
Madam Chair, that's correct. And the majority of the statutes that we find throughout our different titles do include confidentiality agreements. That's true. Here's a few other examples, historically speaking, of when confidentiality agreements were used. There's the applications received from participants when Governor Palin's AGIA, when those applications occurred, they were deemed to be strictly confidential.
Yes, Senator Welikowski.
Thank you. Excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair. So this is the point I have to take issue with you. And I don't think that's accurate. I think that's completely inaccurate, in fact, because here's what 160 says, 4390-160. It says, and I'm reading directly from it, if I could, Madam Chair.
Yes, please.
Information that the commissioners have determined is proprietary or a trade secret under 40 AS 4391-50 may not be made public even after notice is published. That's what 4391-50 or 160 says. Then it refers to 4391-50, and here's what 4390 and AGIA said. At the request of the applicant, information submitted under this chapter that the applicant, which at that time would have been the person, company applying, which would have been TransCanada or Sinopec or whoever, identifies and demonstrates is proprietary or is a trade secret, is confidential and not subject to public disclosure under AS 40.25. After the license is awarded, all information submitted and not determined by commissioners to be proprietary shall be made public. So what we did under AGIA was we said if a company believes that information is proprietary, the burden is on them. They come forward and they prove, hey, this is proprietary trade secret information. And then if the commissioners determine that it is indeed proprietary or trade secret, then it's confidential. That's very different than what we did under Senate Bill 138, the gas line bill. Under Senate Bill 138, what we said, Section 24, which is AS 3805-020B-12, we said the commissioner may, enter into confidentiality agreements to maintain the confidentiality of information related to contract negotiations and contract implementation associated with the North Slope Natural Gas Project. So what we did was we allowed the commissioner to say anything related to contract negotiations, anything related to contract implementation can be confidential. That's virtually everything. And that's the problem that many of us have with the confidentiality provisions of SB 138. Way too broad, way too broad. And it gives the commissioner that sole right to determine what's confidential or not, as opposed to having the applicants come forward and say, hey, this is proprietary, this is a trade secret, I want you to treat it that way, commissioner designates. It's very different. I think it's apples and oranges what you're talking about.
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I do agree there is a different structure as it relates to SB 138 and as it relates to the application process for AGIA. And I was just using this more of an example to understand that the different confidentiality agreements that do occur throughout the history. And as far as the specifics go, there are those distinctions. There's no doubt about that. And if you look at some of the applications, and if you look at some of the confidentiality agreements that they presented to us, they all have different provisions in each one. So I don't disagree with anything you just said. I just wanted to set the table, so to speak, to just demonstrate how they are used and what they are. I wasn't making an opinion one way or the other as to the distinctions. So,
follow-up, Senator Welikowski?
No.
All right, thank you. Senator Michicki.
I'm not disagreeing, through the chair, I'm not disagreeing with Senator Welikowski, but I believe, and I'm going from memory because I don't have my code book in front of me, perhaps you can look for me, but I believe the final line in the AGIA confidentiality allowed the commissioners to deem something confidential, which essentially results in the same that's under the gas 138. Is that not correct, that the final line says that the commissioners do have the power to deem something confidential in AGIA?
What it, if I could, Madam Chair.
Yes, please, Senator Welikowski.
What Senate Bill 138 allows basically says the commissioner has the right to declare all information related to contract negotiations and contract implementation which is virtually everything. It could be any emails. It could be a phone call that documents that he had. It could be an email document. Any related is extremely broad in the legal sense. That's very different than under AGEA, where it was the applicant's obligation to come forward and prove that it was a proprietary or trade secret. And that's why that, and that's a huge difference, because ultimately, you're right, the commissioner under AGEA did have the right to determine what, whether it was proprietary or a trade secret, but that's a very specific item of information, and that's very different than what was agreed to in Senate Bill 138, which caused a lot of heartburn with a lot of people, such like myself.
Yeah. Madam Chair, just for final statement, I think the end result is the same. If the commissioner can determine that something is proprietary or a trade secret, it doesn't give sideboards under the AGEA license, the AGEA legislation. I think the result is similar.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, I just want to clarify that for a lot of these confidentiality agreements, the ones that we've researched, almost all of them have different provisions related to it. I just wanted to make sure that we understood the historical context. So going down through the list then, this just talks about in 1999, legislators were required to sign confidentiality agreements related to the BP-ARCO merger as it relates to briefing from the Knowles administration. Why it contained proprietary information and state and federal tax issues. And then in 2005, state officials and employees were required to sign confidentiality agreements as it relates to the Woods McKinsey reports that they were analyzing.
So, yes, Senator Sidman had a question.
One more of a comment there, Madam Chairman.
Sure.
As I recall, I signed that Wood McKinsey document back in the day. Subsequent, I guess, a couple years later, after getting more into the detail of the subject matter on the comparative nature of the tax structure with Alaska, why on earth we were required to sign that was beyond me, because I don't recall anything in there that had any real value that we didn't have under ACES or 21 or whatever we worked with. You know, the subject matter. So I guess, you know, from my perspective, I think we need to be a little careful that we don't have to willy-nilly sign a confidentiality agreement. And where those documents are in that WoodMac study, maybe they're still sitting over there, but we spend a lot of money and a lot of time on that subject matter with, multitude of consultants.
Thank you, Senator Sidman.
Thank you. So we went ahead and we did some research as it relates to different non-statutory confidentiality agreements as it relates to the executive branch's interaction with some of the private sector entities. And we were able to get a sampling from a few different departments, and that sampling is before you on slide 10. The first one deals with DNR and just talks about some of the appendices and the request for proposal procedures, the standard operating procedures to have a non-disclosure and confidentiality agreement, forbidding contractors to disseminate some of the proprietary information going forward. Department of Health and Social Services has something similar when it comes to some of their business associates in the private sector when maintaining health information. And then Department of Public Safety also has a similar confidentiality agreement as it relates to some of the grant recipients. So I just wanted to make sure that's clear. Senator Wachowski makes a good point. They are all different, and that's what they are. They do certainly occur as it relates to the different departments and at times the legislative branch. If you have any questions, further questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Hutchinson. Further questions from committee members? All right, seeing none, thank you.
Okay.
Yes, Senator Cuckier.
So I'll take the hit for not having this, because I previewed this before we got to committee. So what I would ask is, before you put it on the basis, that we get who was the instigator in this. So it should come from my office for majority counsel.
Okay.
And so it was a good catch on the Senator Stoll's part. And I'll have to take the hit for it because I reviewed it before we got here, so my apologies.
It was meant to be very constructive. I'm a stickler on historical reference.
I appreciate that because sometimes I go back and look at documents and wonder when and where they came from. I believe it's already posted, but we will post the corrected one.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Hutchinson. Good report. So the next person to speak is Acting Commissioner Randall Hoffbeck. So I will invite Mr. Hoffbeck to the table. Yes, welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Randy Hoffbeck, I am the Commissioner of Revenue. And with me, I have Jerry Burnett, the Deputy Commissioner of Revenue as well, who has about 28 more years of experience with revenue than I do, and in case there's some detailed questions that the committee may have that I can't answer. As far as the Department of Revenue is concerned, we have a bit of a mixed bag in that some of our information is confidential and some of it isn't. For most cases, that's a secure workplace, any place where we do keep confidential records, so that is a secure area. And as far as any employees that handle confidential data, they do get annual training on confidentiality as well. One thing I should point out, that this particular discussion is going to focus primarily on confidentiality as it relates to the tax division, but we do have confidentiality provisions as well within the permanent fund division, and child support enforcement also has a great deal of confidential data. One of the reasons that confidentiality is necessary within the Department of Revenue is that our primary mission is to collect, administer, and audit Alaska's tax revenues. And in order to do that, we need access to proprietary and confidential commercial data in order to do so. And so it is a very important component of the Department of Revenue, the idea of confidentiality. Another of our missions is to forecast and report revenues. And that largely involves data collected in the tax, under the tax regime, but we also request and are often given information voluntarily by industry that allows us to make better forecasts. And the reason that they give that to us is because that we have historically kept it confidential. Confidentiality within the Department of Revenue is largely statutorily driven. And there's a few statutes here, and I'll run through them briefly, and I apologize for essentially reading them, but there's probably not a lot better way to get them on the record. AS 4305-230 states that it's unlawful for a current or former officer, employee, or agent of the state to divulge the amount of income or particular set out or disclosed in a report or return in this title. So basically, we can't divulge income information that's provided under AS 43, which is the revenue and taxation statutes. AS 4025 states that information in the possession of the Department of Revenue that discloses the particulars of business affairs of a taxpayer or another person is not a matter of public record. So it's very clear that that information is not public record. And 4320-21A adopts the Internal Revenue Code as in reference to taxpayer information, primarily as it relates to the income tax. There are substantial consequences for releasing confidential data now that the employers are made very much aware of. That a willful violation is punishable by fine of not more than $5,000 or imprisonment of not more than 2 years. That's enough to keep people's attentions. But there's two sides to the coin, and there's also within the AS 11, which talks about the offenses against public administration, there is also the requirement that data that is public record and can be released cannot be kept confidential arbitrarily, and that in, or by intent, and that that is a Class A misdemeanor to do that as well. So there's both sides of the coin that, that need to be balanced. Definitely statutes drive what is confidential, but there's also this overriding policy within public administration that records that are not specifically confidential should be made available to the public. So what kind of information can be disclosed? Exceptions that are under AS 4305-230 talks about information that's necessary for investigations and appeals and child support proceedings. Child support proceeding has access to most, if not all, the data that we hold. We provide information to the Department of Natural Resources for purposes of their auditing, for their audit functions. We also provide information to DEC and Department of Fish and Game on business tax related to those particular entities. We can share with federal and other state organizations if they can prove that they have an appropriate safeguards in place. And then, then the information on various other taxes can also be shared between agencies. This isn't information that's being shared with the public necessarily here, but it's information that's shared between agencies, and we have the right to do that. Other information that can be disclosed that relate to oil and gas are the that have come in recently in HB 280 in 2010. It said that the name of each person claiming a credit and the amount of the credit for each gas storage facility is public information. And then SB 138 in 2014 said that each person electing to pay production tax as gas, the amount of the gas produced for each lease of the property is also public information. So those are some very specific things that we're allowed to release. And less specifically, we have the provisions within 4355-890 that allows us that if we aggregate information in such a way that it can't easily be deconstructed to find out the specific information of a specific taxpayer, that we can also release information to the public within that as well. So data needs to be aggregated, obviously, by at least three. If you had two, the other person would always know what the other one was doing. So it has to be at least three, and in such a fashion that it can't be parsed out from that information. And so we routinely aggregate information on collections, credits, production volumes, with the issues that are on here. And you see a lot of that in the revenue sources book. A lot of that information is aggregated information. And again, the same information here that we do request and receive a lot of private taxpayer data, including plans and projections that are necessary for us to actually do our job. And some cases they're required to provide it. Some cases they do it voluntarily, but have done so in the past because of the treatment of keeping those records confidential. I just kind of wanted to make a kind of a final statement before closing, that the Department of Revenue recognizes the necessity to keep certain data confidential. And the statutes largely drive general categories of what needs to be kept confidential, a little bit more specific in what can be released as public information. But in between that, there is a gray area where it's hard to necessarily determine whether, in fact, it falls under some of the statutory requirements to keep it confidential. So one of the first things that we did when we got to the Department of Revenue, I've asked for all the confidentiality agreements and our policies and procedures for vetting confidential data. And that's being reviewed right now to make sure that, in fact, we have the right balance between releasing information into the public and keeping confidential what is important for our constituent taxpayers to feel that they're adequately protected as well.
Very good. Questions from committee members? I had a question for you. So here's a theoretical. What if a legislator wanted to review that information and they agreed to sign a confidentiality agreement? Is that possible for them to then review the tax information? I assume that the penalties under law would apply.
I'm not really sure.
Okay.
Certainly, we require it from all of our staff. I'm not sure how far broadly that would go, and whether it would go to the legislature. But I can find out.
Okay. Just wondering. Any further questions? Senator Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Hoffbeck, I'm unclear what really constitutes a release of information. I've heard, just hypothetically, if a legislator served on the ARCO-BP merger or served on, and they make pronouncements during a tax debate one way or another, well, I'm voting this way or this way because of the information that I've read in a confidential manner, and it certainly is an implication, especially, even the BP-ARCO merger, there were such a small number of people involved with that, and just hypothetically, if someone said, I'm voting, I can't support or will support this because of what I know from, you're not actually disclosing information, but you're certainly trying to lead somebody to a pretty suggestive inference. Is that border on a release of confidential information? Hypothetically?
Through the chair, Senator Stoltz, I'm not an attorney, but...
You're not apologizing, I hope.
No.
You're just declaring?
I'm just declaring.
Okay.
But I can, for personal experience, I can go back to some of the issues that were associated with the property tax litigation with Trans-Alaska Pipeline, which I was involved in. And certainly we were able to make determinations based on confidential data. We just couldn't release the specifics of that data. And so I'm thinking that somebody voting saying that based on what they've read, they're going to vote one way or the other. I can't see where that could in any way reveal the commercial data underlying the
Do you think we could, Madam Chair, get the yes. counsels from the Department of Revenue and the Attorney General's office to clarify that?
I think that'd be interesting to
that
do.
That would probably
yes.
carry a lot more weight than what I just said. Yes.
We'll
that's
do
a
that.
Standing request. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you
Chair.
Very much, Senator Stoltz. Any further questions?
Just
yes,
a comment.
Senator Kokel.
First of all, I was pleased to see these comments. Many of us legislators worked on trying to make sure that people's personal information was kept safe by the government. And so I think we worked hard on that. But in the balance of that, trying to figure out when the government does something that impacts people, what right do they have to know? So. I was glad to see the high bar on one side, and I guess we'll be watching for it on the other side.
Yeah. Appreciate that. Madam Chair, thank you for letting me go first so I can.
I know you've been on the hot seat quite a bit today. So
my voice is almost gone.
Oh, dear. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. The next person we're going to hear from is Commissioner Kathy Forrester with the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. Welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you. My name is Kathy Forrester. I'm the Engineering Commissioner and the current Chair of the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, or AOGCC. Senator Giesel, Vice Chair Costello, and Senators, thank you for the opportunity to explain how confidentiality is treated at the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. And you're a group of my favorite people, and thanks for the opportunity just to visit with you. First, for those unfamiliar with the AOGCC, which is certainly none of you, I'll give a bit of background information. We're the agency responsible for regulating oil, gas, and geothermal exploration, development, and production operations throughout the state of Alaska. We oversee all drilling, all well work, and well production operations on all lands within the state of Alaska and in state waters. We also ensure that custody transfer metering, the measurement that rings the state's cash register, is done accurately. The AOGCC receives a large volume of information from operators every day. Most of the information is stored in our non-confidential well file system and also posted on our website, both of which are open to the public and easily available. However, we frequently receive information that we are required by statute to keep confidential. The most common example of data that we are required to keep confidential relates to exploratory wells. Our statutes are very clear on that data. they say that required reports and information that relate to an exploratory or stratigraphic test well and those portions of an application for a permit to drill such a well that contain proprietary information shall be confidential for 24 months unless the owner of the well gives permission to written permission to release the data and information earlier. That exact wording can be found at AS 31.05.35C. Another example is data that an operator is not required by statute to provide, but that they voluntarily provide. Again, our statutes are very clear. They say that information not required by statute, but voluntarily filed with the commission, shall be kept confidential if the person filing the information so requests. That exact wording can be found at AS 31.05.35D. So what sorts of information would an operator volunteer and want to hold confidential? The answer to this question is not spelled out in our statutes, but it's still pretty clear. An operator often wants to share information that's interpretive or company proprietary so that the commission can understand the operator's reasoning behind a request or an action. Examples would be a structure map, a net pay map, a structural cross-section. Another example is a reservoir simulation model, its construction, its input data and assumptions, as well as its output. All of these examples involve technical interpretation and the use of companies' proprietary tools and technology. Now, to make it easier to visualize, let's look at a very specific instance where we have used AS 31.05.035D to treat as confidential voluntarily provided information, i.e. data and information neither required nor requested by the AOGCC. And the example I want to give you is one that many of you are very familiar with since we talk about it every time I come to see you. Since both Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson meet the state of Alaska's definition of oil fields, no gas may be removed from either without an offtake allowable determined by the AOGCC. This requirement is in place to ensure that waste does not occur because removing gas from an oil field before all the oil has been produced generally results in loss of some of the oil. For AOGCC to make such a gas offtake allowable determination, the operator of the field must demonstrate that hydrocarbon losses will not occur. This demonstration typically involves complicated geologic and engineering analyses, and for both Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson, I can guarantee that is the case. Shortly after I arrived at the commission in 2005, we began preparing for that inevitable ask by gathering the technical and analytical information, all of which the operators hold as proprietary and confidential. Thus, as part of the process, AOGCC technical staff signed confidentiality agreements with both the Prudhoe Bay and the Point Thompson operators. Obviously, confidentiality does not apply to information submitted as part of a public process. That said, our regulations regarding hearings clarify that if disclosure of otherwise confidential information is required for the commission to make a decision, the commission will protect that data's confidentiality by viewing it in camera and redacting it from the public record. That really sums up how confidentiality works within the AOGCC. I hope this has been helpful, and I welcome any questions that you might have.
Questions for Commissioner Forster? Commissioner, you must hold executive meetings and executive sessions.
We go into a deliberative process after a hearing, or when we try to avoid gathering for deliberative processes as a threesome, except in the public record, so that we don't violate the Public Records Act. So we don't have executive meetings. We try to make our decisions based on what has come in the public process, and then through individual deliberations, if that makes sense. We don't get together and say, after a hearing, and say, well, what are we going to do with that? We have staff that gathers all the data that is gathered in the hearing and synthesizes it for us in a way that is easy for us to understand and follow. The staff also makes recommendations. Based on all of this data, this is what we recommend the decision be, and that each individual commissioner looks at that recommendation, and each of us individually can call in the staff and say, I don't agree with you. Let's talk about this. And sometimes that will result in the staff going back and revising their recommendation, and sometimes it will result in the commissioner going, oh, I get it. So, but we try really hard not to violate the Public Records Act. So sometimes we'll socialize, but we don't do business as a three unless we do it on the public record.
So I'm just trying to logistically visualize this. Having served on a regulatory board, which does hold executive sessions when hearing information about complaints and from our assistant attorney general, legal advice concerning a case, because that's a quasi-adjudicatory body, right, a regulatory board. So when you're receiving this confidential information about, the gas and how much oil is still left, et cetera, do the companies come to you and sit down and convene a meeting in executive session? I don't understand
okay.
how that works.
Good question. There are two things that happen. One, our technical staff signed those confidentiality agreements. So they meet, and they use all the data that they have compiled through those studies to formulate their recommendations to us. Now, let's stay with the gas offtake. So we'll have an engineer and a geologist that will sign a confidentiality agreement. They will go through the details of BP's or Exxon's reservoir simulation model. They'll understand the input. They'll agree that the construction of the model uses good engineering practices, that the geologic description is valid, and that all of the input assumptions that went into the model make sense based on the data we have. And then they'll say, well, run this case. What'll happen if in 2020 you decide to start taking 4.5 B a day out of Prudhoe Bay? And so our technical staff will gather all kinds of information that they won't share with me or the other commissioners because we didn't sign the confidentiality agreement. But then the recommendations that they make to us will be based on the data that's in their heads. Now, but before we ever get to the point where we'd be making a decision, there would be a public hearing. And in that public hearing, we would require, whether it's Exxon or BP, depending on what it's Point Thompson or Prudhoe, we would require that operator to present as much information for the public record as is possible. And we always push for make it public. And if they say, well, there's other stuff we need to show you, but it's company propriety or trade secret or what have you, then we will hold an in-camera session. And during that session, we may say, wait a minute, that's not proprietary. If you still want to include that in the data and information that we are going to use to consider our decision, you're going to have to put it on the public record. Otherwise, we're not considering it. So and this happens in hearings all the time. In fact, we had an operator come in a while back, and they got stamp happy with the confidential stamp, and they had the cover sheet that said name of company, stamped confidential. And in that case, we said before we start the hearing, we're going to have to go with you page by page, and you're going to have to justify every single page that you've made confidential. And the result of that was they said, never mind, none of it's confidential. So the monkey is on our back to make them justify that what they're asking for confidentiality on truly is confidential. And so going back to that gas offtake hearing, the operator would come in and they'd say, well, here's all the stuff we want to share with the public, but we think there's a little more that we just want to show you guys. So we go to an in-camera session, and at the end of that session, we have very clear direction on, and it's in the statutes, on what kinds of things are and are not confidential. And at the end of that in-camera session, we would say, all good except, and then you can either choose to pull that or disclose it. And then after that, we conclude the hearing, the staff makes a recommendation, and we go through that process I described. But I sit in my office and read that recommendation and ask my questions. Commissioner Seamount sits in his office, reads. However, that said, if we have a legal question, we will call in our assistant attorney general, and all three of us will sit with him, and we will, you know, that is part of our deliberative process that we do as a group. We try really hard not to violate the Open Records Act, and we try really hard to honor what needs to be confidential, but not allow anything that shouldn't be held confidential. Did I answer your question?
Yes, very well. Senator Wielkowski has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good to see you again. At the heart, what you're trying to protect is trade secrets and proprietary information. Is that fair to say?
Senator Wielkowski, through the chair. Yes. Data and information that the company has acquired that gives it a competitive edge, for example, an exploratory well, is the reason that the statutes allow the data that's gathered in the drilling of an exploratory well to be held confidential for 2 years is that this company goes out and spends millions of dollars drilling that well, acquiring all that data. There may be unleased acreage around it, and the investment they've made gives them a competitive edge that the statutes recognize shouldn't be handed out for free like Halloween candy.
Follow-up, Senator Wielkowski? Senator Stoltz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When I first got here as an elected House member, I got one of those confidential stamps from supply, and I'd put it on all my documents and hope people would read it, because and there was always an extra impetus of reading something you weren't supposed to read. The question I have, you mentioned yourself and Mr. Seamount. This is one of the more important regulatory boards. Is there a third? I've heard some rumors and swirls about a new appointment. Who is that and what's their background?
We just got a new commissioner on Thursday, and his name is Mike Gallagher. And we had some conversation and about his background, and I will portray to you what he described to me, with the caveat that I haven't read his
her
bio.
Or anything.
Yeah, whatever you want to call it, in whatever language you want to call it. But I'll portray to you as best as I can recall what he portrayed to me. But to get a better answer, you should get it from him. He grew up in Michigan, and he was going to college in Michigan when he heard that money could be made working in Alaska. So he and a good buddy came to Alaska and got jobs doing construction on the pipeline. And he said that when the pipeline was completed, he got a job doing maintenance on the pipeline. And he continued in that area. And when he retired, he got bored and came back to work. And I'm not sure what he came back to work doing. But then he got a call from the governor asking him to come in and be on the ALGCC.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was actually more than I had asked. Well, I was hoping I was a lawyer or an engineer or whatever. But thank you for that. And I assume that'll probably come through one of the committees that somebody here sits on. And I'm sure that'll be explored. I was just
probably
curious.
This committee, yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Stoltz. Further questions for Commissioner Forrester? Seeing none. Thank you very much, Commissioner.
Thank you all. It is always a delight to see you guys.
You're under oath.
All right. Our next speaker is Acting Director Paul Decker from the Division of Oil and Gas, Department of Natural Resources. Welcome, Mr. Decker.
Thank you. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, so for the record, my name is Paul Decker. I'm a petroleum geologist by background and am currently in interim acting status as director of the Division of Oil and Gas. So I was happy to make it today, and I'd like to work you through a few slides. Some common themes, I think, with what you may have already heard, and especially with a lot of what Commissioner Forrester had to say many of the same principles apply at DNR in the Division of Oil and Gas as they do to her agency. But most importantly, you know, the takeaway here is that most of the records in the division are public. Only limited kinds of information can be maintained or would be maintained as confidential, and that's only when confidentiality is explicitly provided for in the laws that we work under. And as she said as well, confidentiality is not really presumed or taken for granted just because somebody went stamp happy with the confidentiality stamp. In many cases, we have to sort of work through that just as they do. DNR, though, tries to implement and strike a balance, you know, that the legislature, I think, has provided some direction for us on. The idea that more confidentiality allows us, keeping things confidential allows us to gather more data than we would ordinarily be able to obtain. So it gets more data to the state. On the other hand, more disclosure promotes greater transparency and better insight into the operation of state government, why the decisions have been made that have been made. So, as we said before, under the Alaska Public Records Act, AS 40.25, agency records are public documents unless otherwise stated. But DNR's primary confidentiality statute is AS 3805-035A8, and that specifically lists six categories of information that are to be kept confidential upon request. So just listing few there, those six, the names of nominators or applicants for land disposals, in other words, if somebody would like to obtain an exploration license, for example, or would like to nominate a certain area for lease sales, their name and their application would be confidential. The names of the bidders and the bid values that ultimately submit sealed bids. Again, lease sales is a good example, also exploration licenses that can become competitive bid. Any and all geological, geophysical, and engineering data, and often we shorten that mouthful to GG&E. So that's really the technical data. Also financial data, financial information. That's another very broad category. Some other things that don't come into play as often, especially with the Division of Oil and Gas, are things like right-of-way applications and information about public agency land planning. Not really the big hitters in the DOG confidentiality. As Commissioner Hoffbeck mentioned, DOR has provisions for sharing some of its data with DNR, specifically oil and gas, when it comes to adjudicating tax credits. For example, the exploration tax credits under 4355-025 and 023 are good examples where the program is offered through Department of Revenue's statutes, but part of the responsibility for adjudicating those credits is to make sure that DNR actually gets the data that is to be submitted and eventually made public. So that's our role in those. But until it becomes public, we have to treat that all very confidentially. There are some other confidentiality statutes applied by our division, royalty audits and royalty board issues, and you can see the citations there. So really, as a practical matter, almost all of the confidential data that we get within the Division of Oil and Gas comes as either GG&E data, that's the technical information, or financial information. And some examples up here, most of the examples, for GG&E data, these would be things like data submitted under the terms of the lease and exploration license obligations, any seismic data or other data acquired through a miscellaneous land use permit has conditions that then that data needs to be turned over to the state for its use. And in the case of seismic data, that maintains confidentiality in perpetuity under most MLUP instances. Unit and participating area applications would be another example. Say a company has formed a unit out of leases and needs to expand its participating area to encompass more acreage. That's one example of why they would be submitting data to the state, to the Division of Oil and Gas, that we would keep confidential. There's also, in addition to the DOR tax credit 4355 provisions that I mentioned a moment ago, there's also an older incentive credit program under AS 3805-180I that did have some action, but we haven't seen any wells drilled under that or seismic acquired under that provision for, I believe, more than 15 years or so. So it's been quite some time that the newer tax credits are more popular. Financial information would be things, for example, financials submitted to assure that a company is good for its DR&R obligations, dismantling, removal, and rehabilitation of infrastructure on their leases. Also, if a company would like to ask for royalty modification, that is a clear instance where we are going to demand quite a lot of information from them, financial information that they would ordinarily not share with us, to assess the project viability with and without the royalty modification. DOR tax filings and supplemental reports are sometimes submitted, again, for our commercial analysts to understand the companies better. Major projects, for example, as Commissioner Forster spoke of, forward-looking projects that are not actually up for a decision right now. There's no application before us to rule on, so we're not really ready to make a regulatory application, a regulatory decision, and therefore we're not in a position to demand data. But when companies agree to give us a look out into the future at a major project, for example, the gas pipeline projects over the years, we have actually found it necessary to sign more restrictive confidentiality agreements so that we can get that voluntary look at very detailed, very, very sensitive information. And then a couple of auditing issues, net profit share lease audits, making sure that we understand the field cost deductions and so forth that they're working in before asserting that their leases have gone into payout. Also, royalty sales contracts and invoices, and I think there's an example further into the talk that we'll get to on that. So why is confidentiality important? What's the value to the division? And this is looking at it in sort of a holistic, general, everyday sense. Over the decades, confidentiality has allowed the division to amass and interpret vast quantities of data that is absolutely critical to understanding our resources throughout the state. And this is both, you know, the subsurface geology, the GG&E data, as well as the commercial information about the commercial landscape. So the subsurface geology, think both in broad brush regional terms, basin scale knowledge that we need to understand the resources, whether they've been discovered and developed or just remaining undiscovered resource, or even down at the scale of individual reservoirs. Once these things go into production, it's very important that we understand these in detail. The commercial environment has to do with things like the royalty modification that I spoke of, the viability of projects, also the DR&R liability that projects would have, and just simply making sure that the state, through the auditing process, is getting the full value of its share of royalty, net profit share, et cetera. So as some of the other speakers this afternoon have mentioned, sometimes this information comes to us voluntarily because the operators are aware that we have the ability to maintain confidentiality. And so they can provide a bit more than they might otherwise simply because they help inform us and better understand their application or their issue of the day. So diligently protecting that confidentiality is really critical to our ability. We take it very seriously, and it's part of managing our lands effectively. So what I wanted to do here, we don't need to go through these all in great detail. I'll start bit by bit on the first example. I have four examples here, making the point that various types of confidential data arrive in the Division of Oil and Gas from different sources for various reasons and are stored by and used by different sections within the division. So here's an example, the first one being seismic data submitted under the DOG permit requirements. So this would be, say, the multiple land use permit requirements. This data would be turned into the division through the terms of the permit. It would be extended permanent confidentiality, or unless the company said you can go ahead and release that, and we'd gladly take them up on that. But it's granted permanent confidentiality as the default in this case. And it's used exclusively by the geophysicists and the geologists of the resource evaluation section to understand the subsurface. So how does that life cycle look? The data comes in from the operator. It's inventoried to a database, indexed, very carefully stored and archived, including all the many different kinds of components and file types within that data. The copy is then made off to the secure network where we can begin to use it, while the original material, the original digital media, are stored in our highly confidential secure vault in the Atwood
Excuse
building.
Excuse me, Director Decker. Senator Wielichowski had a question for you.
Thank you. So the seismic studies that are being done, that are being maintained confidential, I guess we still have exploration tax credits which can pay for 80, 90, 100% of this. Probably not now under lower oil prices, but is that information that the state's paying huge percentages of, is that being kept confidential or is that released?
Through the chair, Senator Wielichowski, that's an important distinction. This is an example. In this particular example, this is really just the MLUP seismic that has really contributed to most of the data that we've acquired over the years, most of the seismic we've acquired over the years. But you're absolutely right. The DOR tax credit programs under 025 and 023 very clearly call for release of the seismic data eventually. And most of those have a 10-year confidentiality period. The newer Frontier Basin tax credits, or sometimes called the Middle Earth credits, that were approved, I think, in 2012, they carry a much higher proportion of the state investment, you know, like the 80%. I think it's 75% actually for seismic. And because that was such a generous support there, the legislature made the confidentiality period on those credits 2 years for seismic.
Thank you.
So, okay, so in any case, in this particular example, the data are loaded, quality checked, brought into, prepared for the interpretation software where the geophysicists can actually work with the information. That data is then interpreted. We make subsurface maps of that data. We also have to integrate it and reconcile it with previously acquired data that might, you know, for various reasons, have a slightly different story or a slightly different signal-to-noise ratio or what have you, you know, that might cause some angst in reconciling the differences. These confidential interpretations then go on and inform our technical recommendations on things like lease sales, unitization applications, any decision about the management of reservoir lands. Whether or not it impacts the actual operator that submitted that data set or not, you know, we can use that data confidentially for the greater good. This kind of data would be permanently retained within the division, and it is really truly useful forever in some way or another, so it's never destroyed.
Director Decker, so recently the division, the Department of Natural Resources Commissioner, made the determination for a Calus royalty modification. And there is a point where their data will have to be given out, be public information. I can't remember what that time frame was. Do you remember it right offhand?
Madam Chair, my memory of that is really not clear as to what time all of the information needs to be released. I do know that we very carefully redacted their application, which was stamped entirely confidential, in order for that to go out to public comment. So I'm not sure if that answers your question, but certainly the public comment period included, you know, releasing what we had very carefully redacted and made sure that we could only redact the information that was very truly confidential. So,
all right. Thank you. Senator Wielichowski has a question.
Thank you. Two parts, or two questions, I guess. Number one, it would seem to me that the vast majority of seismic studies is done with credits. Is that, if you could talk about what percentage, number one, and number two, is this information then shared with AOGCC?
Through the chair, Senator Wielichowski, I believe you're correct that most of the seismic data acquired within the last 10 or 11 years since these credits have been available would have been, most of the seismic would have been acquired under these DOR credit programs. And is that data supplied to the AOGCC? No, it is not. That's not within our ability with the statutes. The data that are confidential remain within the Department of Natural Resources until they are released, and then the entire public can use those.
Follow up, Senator. Follow up.
Thank you. It seems to me that this would be very valuable information for the AOGCC to have. Is that something that you've discussed with them? As the manager of our resource?
So, through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I'm not aware of any situation where the commission has, at least not during my time in the division in the last 10 years, where the commission has approached us for access to the seismic data, for example. I believe, and certainly Commissioner Forster, please correct me if I'm wrong, I believe that there are times when they approach the companies directly about, is there information that you could share with them to improve the decision-making?
Why don't we get an actual answer to your question? Commissioner Forster, would you please come up and...
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You bet. Thank you.
I'd just be curious if this would be helpful for you to have and if statutory changes need to be made.
Again, for the record, Kathy Forster from the AOGCC. Senator Wilikowski through the chair. When an operator needs to show us seismic or other GG&E information to help us understand a request that they're making to so that we can reach a decision, they generally give us that information, and they give it to us with the understanding that it's voluntary, it's proprietary, it's that stuff that's protected, and we honor it that way. But we don't, and I've been here the same 10 years that Paul has been here, and I can't think of a time when we've gone, gee, I wish we had more data that DNR could give us. Because, you know, if we needed it, we would suggest that the operator give it to us. We don't need a middleman.
All right, great. Thank you very much, Commissioner Forster.
Okay, just continuing on then. Let's look at another example of the life cycle of some of the data that comes in. In this example, let's look at a North Slope exploration well that was submitted pursuant to the DOR tax credits. These are under sort of the Wildcat drilling credits, 4355.025. So this is an example where a well would have temporary confidentiality. And that assumes that it's not on private land, for example. In which case, for this particular credit, the private landowner would need to give authorization for the data to become public, and that is in the statute. But this, again, is data used primarily by the resource evaluation section, the technical staff. So very similar to what you saw before, you know, that it comes in, it gets inventoried into an index, into an archive, and this includes really all of the well data collected, not only the information that would be required to be submitted to the AOGCC under their statutes. When these regulations, or when the statutes were put together for the tax credits, it said, hey, we're giving an awful lot of money to help see these projects through. We need to see all of your data that you collect in this particular well, for example. So, again, the data come in and it gets copied. The secure media is retained in the vault. It's loaded, QC'd, prepared for interpretation. We make a secure backup of that very, very expensive data. And then, again, it's reviewed and interpreted internally by the experts to help inform technical recommendations, things like lease sales, exploration potential, unit actions, et cetera. Now, the difference here is that the data set needs to be prepared for release. And that has turned out to be quite the onerous task, as a matter of fact. It's been surprisingly difficult. But that is in fact the case. The data would go public after about 2 years. It's a 30-day period plus a 24-month period plus a 30-day public comment period. But it's essentially timed to coincide with the AOGCC's exploration well confidentiality period, 2 years. So with that, let's move on to a financial example. Financial data obtained for royalty audits under AS 3805.036. This is one, again, where the data would be permanently confidential, and this is used primarily by our royalty audit section. So they obtain the data from the lessees during the audit or just before the audit commences. It's all copied, backed up, and it's then used to analyze the lessees' confidential sales contracts, invoices, and other information to verify field prices that lessee has experienced and sort of make sure that that is reviewed then in context with other producers' similar information. No one sees it all except for our audit staff, but it's compared for the purposes of determining the higher of values for audit claims. And if you're familiar with that, it's the idea of all operators in a certain region that provide us royalty in value. We get sort of the basket of prices, and we deserve and obtain the higher value royalty out of that basket of sales. So this data then would be retained indefinitely within the division, and it's very useful in the future when another audit comes up or an appeal comes up that this data needs to be referred to. One other example, this would be specific to your question about royalty modification, and you're right, the Kalis Nuna royalty modification application for the Uguric unit is a good example here. So the financial data that came in falls squarely under our statutes. It can be permanently confidential, and it's used primarily by our commercial section to analyze. It comes in a mix of hard copy and digital. The hard copy is on our secure network. The hard copies are stored in the vault. The staff will use both forms to do their analysis. Really, the goal there is to construct economic models that they can model a project and look at its viability to say, would this project go forward if it were not for the royalty modification or some form of royalty modification being solicited by the applicant. So the data and the models are then used to evaluate the application, prepare preliminary findings, respond to the public comment period, and then issue a final finding. And so then those data would be retained within the division permanently. They're forever useful. So just in conclusion, I want to make a few key takeaways. Again, that only limited kinds of information are maintained as confidential. They have to be explicitly identified and approved in the statutes. Confidentiality allows the state to benefit from utilizing data without putting the data owners at a competitive disadvantage. And most of the confidential data within DOG is either of the technical GG&E variety or the financial flavor. The different kinds of data, it's a diverse spread of different data types, and as you saw in those examples, there are some common themes in the way we treat the data, ensure that it's maintained confidential, and so forth. But the different data all have their own particular different needs and different details of their life cycle. And finally, I think the ability to maintain data confidentiality has enabled the division to understand the subsurface resources statewide much, much more clearly and led to much better management decisions than we would have been able to obtain without those statutory provisions. So thank you with that, and I'll certainly try to answer any questions you may have.
Very good. Thank you. Committee members, any questions for Director Decker? Seeing none, I think you've answered them along the way. Thank you very much. Great presentation.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Saltz.
It's departing from where you're on the schedule, but it sure helped me. I think a lot of this confidentiality discussion relates to the Gas Development Board. I mean, it's spurring from that. And I'm scanning the room, and I'm looking at who has the highest pay grade in here. I would serve benefit, and then maybe you want to do it another time. I would like just a little clarification on what the administration's position is from whoever has the highest pay grade in here, what their position is and what stance they've taken legally or politically. Just so I
see Mr. Burnett here. He's a friend of mine. I hate to pick on him, but I mean, it's certainly I don't want to direct something that the chair didn't plan, but
sometimes we dance around it, we don't get to the real question there, and that's been related, a lot of this, and it's much broader on the whole thing, but the gas line development confidentiality, and I guess I've just only heard things through the press, and I would like something on the record with the clarification of what the administration is maintaining their position on confidentiality and their participation and why and so forth. Chair, if I put it off on a rabbit trail, I apologize, but and maybe it's at a future meeting.
Well, just to respond to Senator Stoltz, you know, our purview is ourselves, right? So, but our another responsibility we have is to make sure the public understands how confidentiality is used currently. Sure. So that's the purpose of this. Now, in relation to the LNG projects, of course, that's our next pair of speakers, our consultants talking about its use in other projects around the world. I think that's what they're planning to cover. But we can certainly, of course, talk off the record to individuals. But it's really up to the governor as far as what he's planning to do with his executive staff. So, well,
I guess that would be a request as a member and the public is we facilitate their understanding through these discussions. And me chatting with Jerry or Mr. Burnett or Mr. Hoffbeck, it doesn't. I can't write enough. I can't keep up with Wilkowski on postcards, and let alone statewide. That was my request. And I think there's been a lack of clarity and whether the that. And at a future forum, perhaps. And again, I'm not trying to rabbit trail your committee, but that's really what most of my constituents are asking about is related to the confidentiality. That's been their queries that we've had. It hasn't been about a land sale, and it hasn't been. And I understand that this has been a good process explaining how it works on so many aspects. I'm not meaning to any diminution of that, but anyway, that's on the table.
All right. Thank you very much, Senator Stoltz. Yes, Senator Stedman.
Madam Chairman, I was just saying we got about 10 minutes left, and to finish on time, rabbit trails probably aren't on the agenda.
So I'll welcome Jenik Mayer and Nico Safus to the table. They're going to talk about how confidentiality is used in projects around the world, I'm suspecting. So welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you. Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Nico Safus, a partner in Analytica. I spent about the last 10 years working in the oil and gas industry, most as a consultant with a special expertise in natural gas, and I suspect that I've probably signed more confidentiality agreements than most people in this room. It's the natural course of business for a consultant, so I look forward to sharing my expertise on this particular issue with you. I'll turn it over to Jenik Mayer. He's going to start us off with a presentation. We only have 3 slides, so hopefully we'll be done by 5 o'clock.
Very good.
Thank you. For the record, Jenik Mayer, partner in Analytica. It's now my 4th legislative session here in Juneau, working through Legislative Budget and Audit Committee with a range of committees, including this one. My expertise is principally on project economics and valuation, impact of fiscal terms, those sorts of issues. If we have a single point to make before you today that I think we really can't stress enough, it's that in all this discussion around confidentiality and the conflicting requirements of keeping certain things secret while wanting to maintain an open democratic state and government, it's that there's a really, really fundamental and important division to be drawn that I think we can't stress enough, and that's the division between eventual confidentiality, or in particular eventual transparency of agreements once they're finalized, once they come, for instance, before this body for approval. And at that point, for instance, a great deal of the need for confidentiality around many things goes away, and a surprising amount can be made quite public and quite open. There will, as Nicholas will talk about in a little bit, remain certain things that are exactly, for instance, as Senator Wilkowski referred to, trade secrets, proprietary information that will need to be held back. But the bar for those things should quite rightly be high, that companies should need to show that, yes, this is a trade secret, this is proprietary information, it will damage other things that we do if this gets out, and that shouldn't be released. But overall, once agreements are reached, a lot is capable of being made available openly to the public, and absolutely rightly should be. But there is a really important distinction to draw between that and the need for confidentiality during the negotiating process. Oops, sorry, didn't mean to press that button. When we think about confidentiality during the negotiating process, a lot of the fundamental reason and driver behind the need for that confidentiality isn't about company proprietary secrets, company things that they don't want made available. It's actually much more about protecting the state's negotiating position. In lots of ways, you know, negotiations are like a game of poker, and trying to play a game of poker with all your cards showing doesn't work very well, right? At the moment, under SB 138, the administration is authorized, principally the commissioners of resources and revenue are authorized to go away and negotiate a series of complex, contentious, difficult agreements on everything from potential fiscal stabilization to off-taking and balancing to LNG marketing, a really broad range of things. Those negotiations are going to be things that the state, the administration, but I would suggest the state more broadly, needs to think very, very carefully about what are the state's fundamental interests, what's the state trying to achieve, what does the state realistically think it can achieve, what are the things that the state is absolutely not willing to give up, what are the things that are less important secondary considerations to the state that might be given away as bargaining chips in order to get other things in return. Who is the state negotiating against? It's not negotiating against one monolithic entity. It's negotiating against a series of different companies, different partners, which also have different interests. In some cases, those interests align with each other between companies. In some cases, some companies have natural interests that align with the state and not with each other. Those are all things that the state needs to think through and think through how those things play out. Where are we in alignment with one company and not with the others? How can we use that alignment to put pressure on the other companies? Where do we sit in a room and hear all the companies say they're in alignment on this thing, but actually we know that this company is closer to us than they say in public, and if we just give them this small thing that doesn't matter to us, they'll come to our side and we can use that to pressure the other companies. These are all, you know, fundamental aspects of effectively negotiating these agreements. I think just in describing that and how that plays out, it should be immediately clear that the state's best interest is not served always by that information being broadly available to the public, and in fact can many times be irreparably harmed in terms of what the state can achieve during that negotiating process. Fundamental distinction to be drawn between eventual transparency, what can be made public in the end, and the need to maintain that confidentiality during the negotiating process. To maintain that confidentiality during the negotiating process, then, it seems to me there are really two ways of going about that. One is to say, okay, administration, go off, do this. You need to get the confidential, so just go away and do it. Come back to us with a series of agreements, and we'll look at that then, and those will be available to the public. And we kind of tried that. It was under the Stranded Gas Development Act. And what it meant was that the administration came back and dumped on the legislature hundreds of pages of documents, and the legislature looked at this and said, well, wait a second, why this, 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 and this? I don't understand. I don't like that. And I'm completely blindsided, so no. Whereas if there is a process by which the administration can negotiate some of these things while maintaining a dialogue with legislators about what their assessment of the state's interests are, what can be achieved, what can't, what might be traded off against what, then when something comes back and you see something and where you say, well, I don't really like this clause, you may also know that, well, no one liked that clause, but we gave that away to get this, this, and this. And it seems to me that is actually quite crucial to the democratic process. Without that, it's very hard to see how truly democratic government, where the state's representatives are part of the decision that goes on here and don't just have a take-it-or-leave-it vote at the end, is accomplished. But doing that effectively requires some process, and SB 138 is one approach to how that can be done, to be brought into those negotiations, to understand what the administration is thinking, what it's proposing, to make suggestions on where it should or shouldn't go, that it's quite crucial to the success of those negotiations for that to be able to occur and to occur confidentially.
Back to me, for the record, Nikos Tsafos. I have two slides to finish off the presentation. The first one, I want to talk a little bit about, you know, what do we know about LNG projects when they get the green light? Okay, so I want to talk in general about what is standard practice, you know, having looked at a lot of LNG projects out there that are under consideration that get the green light to go to construction. And I want to focus on five elements here, and I'll add a comment not here on the slide on fiscal aspects. Technical, this is usually the area where you have the most information, lots of information on wells, routes, pipelines, technical specifications. You can usually get a ton of that information. You can even see that from the AKLNG project. Every time Steve Budd gives a presentation, there's a ton of beautiful maps and details about all the facilities and what they look like, how big they are, how many tons of steel they use, et cetera. That's pretty typical for LNG projects. Companies are generally fairly liberal with sharing that information, partly because it's really cool engineering, and I think everyone is really excited about it. Impacts, you usually have a lot of information on impacts. Again, from AKLNG project, you can see that through the FERC process. You'll have a ton of information about how projects impact the local communities, what kind of mitigating actions the companies are taking to protect the local environment, to protect populations, local communities, and so on and so forth. That's pretty typical, especially when you go to non-OECD countries. Especially when there are external lenders, there's usually just a ton more information. If you have the World Bank or other development banks or external creditors, they usually require a lot of that information. When it comes to costs, usually, most often, you have a total cost figure, and you may have some breakdown of the aggregates. Say, here's how much we think we're going to spend on wells and pipelines and the LNG plant. That second part, it's not always the case. The first part, I can only think of a couple of projects that didn't have a cost estimate that was made public at the final investment decision. Usually companies are pretty happy to make that publicly available. When they're not, and I can think of one example, we don't have to talk about it, it was usually because there were huge cost overruns that they were expecting from the beginning. On the financial side, you usually know the basic structure, whether the companies are taking on any debt or not. You know the names of the lenders. You may know the tenor, which is, you know, how long is the loan. You rarely know the price, how much they're actually borrowing from each of their financiers. So things like LIBOR plus 2, which is how you think about financing terms, that's generally rare information to find for an LNG project. Again, I'm trying to think of what you know in the public domain, what I can go find out as a private citizen is doing Google research, not what I know as a consultant having advised some of these companies. The last part is commercial. It gets really tricky. You usually know the number of contracts and counterparties who this LNG project is going to sell gas to, for how long. You may know some of the detailed terms about, you know, who does the shipping, if the LNG is flexible, if it only has to go to Japan or if it can go other places. You may have the parties report whether the price is indexed to oil or not. That's kind of a hit or miss. They may also talk about other terms, what we call S-curves. This is basically a measure that limits volatility. Sometimes you have an overall contract value, and I put in quote here, you know, $20 billion over 20 years. So then as a consultant, you sit down and you do the math, and you're like, okay, that's $1 billion a year divided by the volume, so try to get a price through that. But it doesn't really tell you what the assumptions are, what oil price forecast this is it at. And you almost never get the price formula. So this is – price formula is by far the most sensitive aspect. You know, we've worked with companies where, you know, you have the top leadership of the company that doesn't have access to the price formula of the company. They get approximations. I remember one company that I worked for that had a price formula sort of leaked to the press, and they did a whole IT investigation to try to figure out where that came from. So companies take price formula very, very seriously. If you ask me, probably a little more seriously than they need to, because once projects come online, you can look at other data and try to figure it out. So a lot of people, including me, make a good living out of approximating and guessing confidential information. But even that, companies will never tell you you got it right. They'll look at it, they'll read it, but they'll never tell you, yeah, it's fair. So companies take this very seriously. And I want to make one comment. It's not on the slide about fiscal aspects. If the fiscal system is part of law, so a law that applies to all projects, you know about that. If the fiscal system is part of a negotiation, like a production sharing contract, then it's a mix. Sometimes you have public access to that information. Oftentimes you don't. Sometimes you may have public access to a generic contract that says, look, this is what the production sharing contract looks like in general, but you don't have the specific contract that has been signed between the company and the sovereign. So, again, a sort of a mixed bag there. So having said all that, I want to go to the last slide.
And Nikos, we're actually slightly past 5 o'clock.
Okay.
And I want to respect committee members and not get into the habit of running over. You're coming back on Wednesday.
Okay.
Could you conclude on Wednesday with your last slide?
Absolutely.
All right. That would be great. I just want to respect committee members' time. We got started a little bit late. I apologize, but I know you're coming back on Wednesday.
No problem.
All right. Great. Thank you. So in conclusion, I just wanted to, again, highlight what Senator Stoltz brought out. This was to help the public understand why confidentiality is used by departments already, and Nikos and Janik will elucidate a bit more how we'll be using it in this LNG project. So they'll be back on Wednesday. That's Wednesday, January 28th. So at this time, the meeting will be adjourned. The time is 5:02 p.m. Thank you.